Welcome to our Goldster podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're entering the world of travel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.
Hi, it's so good to see so many of you here today and to see some new names coming up as well. Just some more people coming in. Welcome everybody today. Those of you who've come to all three of my events this week will be very sick of me, but you'll be pleased to know that Humphrey's back next week. Really good to see so many of you today for Inside Story with Damien Labat, who I'm really thrilled to bring to Goldster. So I first met Damien when he was our guest speaker at the Arvon Foundation course that I was teaching. And for those of you who don't know, Arvon Foundation teaches writing courses, and I was really bowled over by Damien talking about this book, The Stopping Places, which we are going to discuss today. But actually, we've just been talking about the fact that Damien's working on something new as well. So welcome, Damien. Really welcome to the Goldster family. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice of you to ask me.
And we're all going through a bit of a storm at the moment, so we are aware that people might get cut off. If Damien or I suddenly disappear, stay there and we will be back as soon as possible. My lights keep going, so it looks like I'm holding a Victorian seance, but I'm not. So just to start off, this book, which has won you many accolades and is fantastic, and I'm going to put the link in the chat soon. How did this come about, and what was it that made you want to write this particular story?
Really, I'm going to hold up another copy because it sort of started with the idea of a map, I think. And I would listen to, you know, I grew up listening to my family telling these stories about places where they used to travel, but also that their focus wasn't really on traveling. It was on the places they used to stop traveling, stopping places. And it occurred to me that there seems to be a sort of difference in the way that actual nomads look at traveling and the way that people who aren't nomadic look at traveling. And the difference is that people who aren't nomadic focus on the movement, whereas the focus for nomads is finding a place to set up your camp, basically, and stop moving, hence the stopping places. And while I was thinking about that, I started to doodle and draw little maps of these places where my family used to go. And eventually it turned into this, but there are many iterations of these maps along the way, some a lot more messy and complicated and some a lot simpler. But I started to think, wow, this is weird. It feels like there's something subversive and slightly naughty about doing a gypsy map. And I think that's true for several reasons. One is that a lot of travellers tend to keep their stopping places to themselves, partly because they wouldn't necessarily want them to be inundated with other people, but partly just, I think, because they wouldn't think other people would be interested. But also, I think there's this idea, which is implicit in a lot of conversations about Romani and other ethnic traveller culture in Britain, which is that gypsies, Romani people and travellers don't actually belong anywhere, really. They sort of should be on the move, or if they're not on the move, then they're not really gypsies anymore anyway. Do you see what I mean? But the idea that they both are actually nomads and they have an historic attachment to certain places, that's an idea that only starts to really come across, I think, if you do draw a map. And other things started to occur to me, like, you know, I drew a pair of crossed cutlasses slightly fancifully by a place called Romana Bridge. And I thought, wow, it's weird. It seems, in relation to gypsies, I thought, would people interpret that as a symbol of violence? You know, a few people were killed in a sword fight in the 17th century in Scotland, in this place. Whereas if you were to see cross swords on a map of England, in the county of Yorkshire, for instance, where the Battle of Towton took place in 1461, I think, the bloodiest battle in the history of England. It's sort of seen as symbolising, I think, not necessarily brutality first and foremost, but history. you know, heritage, the story of England. So I was interested in sort of cheekily putting my culture in that kind of framework where it's not normally situated. It's normally on the front page presented only as a problem because some travellers have pulled on somewhere where people don't want them. And I thought, well, I like the idea of writing about it in terms of heritage and story.
And it is fantastic. I mean, the way that you write is beautiful, but it is a great story. I can thoroughly recommend this. Very good present as well for anybody. So tell us about what's in the book. Tell us about where you grew up and what it was like growing up in the Romani culture with other people just not understanding who you were, where you came from.
Well, in my earliest memories, I don't remember thinking that I was any different to any other children or people. And I think that's probably how most people would feel if they looked back, if you kind of journey back or attempt to journey back to when you were a small child.
One thing that really struck me as you talk about the languages when you're speaking about all the flowers and you talk in your own language and you just knew you couldn't say it at school because if you did, people would treat you differently. And you said the loneliness would begin. And that really struck me, that feeling that you had to keep this language within your family, but you knew you couldn't talk about it with your friends or your teachers.
Well, the language is fundamental because it was through the Romani language, I think, that I began to recognise that there was something slightly different about me and my family, which hadn't necessarily occurred to me before. I'd accidentally use Romani words at school for things. Shushy for a rabbit, or pani for water, or pimeski for tea, just odd words. And people would react in a slightly confused way. What is that? Is it sort of childish gobbledygook? You know, children invent words all the time, and I used to as well. But occasionally the response would be slightly more sort of troubled and tense than that. And I got the impression that people knew, didn't understand necessarily what the word meant, but knew, oh, he's using traveller's words, basically. And then I began to develop an idea, probably around the age of 5 or 6, that not everybody is completely comfortable with who we are for some reason. And then as I got older, I began to recognise that this was doubly strange, really, because actually my family in the past had lived a very different life culturally to the other people around them in southern England, for the most part Hampshire. They were sort of quite confined to one county, really, doing agricultural work. But they had lived a very different life. They had what the Romani writer Maggie Smith-Bendel calls a complete cultural life, which consisted of different living quarters. They lived in wagons and tents. They spoke a different language, which I grew up with the remnants of, but they also did different work to an extent. They had their own songs and music, their own style of tap dancing, of playing the spoons, the violin and things like that. So it was confusing in a way as a child to be associated with all that, when actually a lot of it had gone by the time I was born, or had gone in our family. And what we were left with really was a powerful sense of being different, which sort of gets stronger as you get older. And then for me, in a way, has sort of evaporated strangely in more recent years, but we can come to that later. We still had horses, so we kept horses, whether or not it was practical anymore. It was sort of seen as an essential thing that we had to do, to be au fait with horses. And there was sort of the paraphernalia of mobility was everywhere, whether or not we moved about very much. It sort of was seen as very culturally important to sort of have vehicles everywhere, for everything from flat carts and London trolleys and racing sulkies right up to modern pickups and vans and stuff. It was just everywhere, you know, horse brasses, horse leathers, it was everywhere. So I felt in a way like I was living in the shadows of a completely different culture, which to an extent I still had, but in another way, I'd sort of was bereft of it. And I felt that I'd missed out on adventures that my elders had had. And that was another spur to write this book, because I thought, I don't want to live and die without ever having lived on the road. That was a strong, something that I felt I lacked, really. And that the people who had lived that way had a strength that was quite intoxicating to be around. And I wanted to know how they'd come by that and whether I might possibly get a bit of it myself.
And what was the result of living on the road? What did it feel like? Did you feel really connected? Did you feel like you were playing at it?
The short answer is, initially I felt I was playing at it, but less so as time went on. And it was horrible in the winter and amazing in the summer. And
I can imagine.
the latter part of that in particular, that seasonal aspect, I think, has very much defined the nomadic cultures of temperate and sort of cold countries, is that there's such a powerful dichotomy between the cold and the warm seasons, basically. And everything just becomes, I mean, even when you live in convenient surroundings, things are more difficult by and large in the winter. But when you're living out of doors, they're just exponentially harder. And, you know, for instance, I thought I'd write all of the book on the road, but in the winter I was largely reduced to taking odd scraps of notes in between just the drudgery of getting everything done in terms of living my daily life. So that was something that I hadn't expected. And I absolutely felt that I was, to go back to the first part of your question, that I was sort of playing at it in a way which might even be distasteful, even though I had great reverence for my family and for everybody who lives this way. It did seem slightly strange to be traveling in the way that I was. So I was alone most of the time. Sometimes my wife Candice came with me, but if it looked like it was going to be a particularly arduous or unglamorous trip, I was largely by myself. And gypsies and travelers don't travel by themselves. They travel in large family groups with their children, and they're working on the road. And it's a different, I mean, I was working, writing, but it's not the same as having to go out and do a roofing or tree surgery job and then return to find that your trailer isn't there anymore because your family have had to move it because they've been moved on. Do you see what I mean? So in some ways, I was experiencing the traveler life, but in other ways, definitely not.
Yeah. And how did you plan it? I mean, did you go out really knowing where you were going to go, or did you just want to just go where people told you, or were you very much following the route that your family had set for you?
Well, I knew with great clarity where I wanted to go first. And that's partly why there's a high concentration of places at the bottom of the map. So yeah. I don't know whether this will be in focus, but even if it's not, you can probably see that there's a concentration of places in the south because that's where my family are from. And I wanted to investigate these places that I'd heard the names of so many times. I mean, this is something that I think everybody experiences as a child, is you have the world that you know, that you live in and you move around. And then there's this kind of ghost world of places that your relatives have lived in the past that they constantly talk about, but that you've never seen. So their names are instantly familiar to you, and they have a kind of, in your mind's eye, they have an atmosphere and perhaps even some images associated with them, but you've never been there. And I think that's true for almost everybody alive. But perhaps in my case, there was a large set of these places, the stopping places where my family used to live. And so I wanted to go and see them first, if I could find them, because some of them are difficult to find because travellers have their own names for them. They often named them after the farmer who owned the place and let them stay there. Hence, in my book, there are places called Messenger's Meadow or Butler's Down. And Mr. Messenger and Mr. Butler were farmers who employed gypsies and who knew them well, employed the same families, sometimes dynasties of farmers employed, you know, whole lineages of gypsies, if you like.
Yeah.
But nobody else calls those fields by that name. So going to find them can be interesting if you're by yourself without help.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, I'd hear about other places and I was reading a lot about the culture at the time, and somewhere would crop up and I think, oh, I'll go and investigate that. And some of the places I stayed didn't have an historical attachment to travellers, but were places I just sort of ended up because I needed to to sleep somewhere.
Yeah.
And so they're what I call sort of my stopping places, if you like.
You're creating a new tradition for your descendants.
Perhaps.
Yeah, he's saying kind of maybe 100 years' time, your great-grandchildren will be heading off, going, oh, we're going to go follow in his footsteps, and this will become the next Bible for your
it's
descendants.
It's possible, if indeed I have them.
Exactly. So what did your family think about this? So when you told them you were going to write this book.
This is the fun part. There's sort of three reactions, really. There's the camp that reacts with encouragement. Oh, that sounds interesting. Then there are the ones who I think quite wisely choose to withhold judgment until the book's been written. And then there was an unfortunately quite large camp in my family who didn't agree with the idea of me writing about this at all. And we fell out and we haven't spoken for 7 years.
Wow.
So that is, and I think, I mean, perhaps we can talk more about that. That can be a price of writing, which I hadn't really considered whether or not I'd be willing to pay in advance of writing this book.
Did you ever regret writing it because of that reason?
There were times when I wondered whether I should continue. Definitely.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you have to come down on one side or the other. And this has got nothing to do with Romani culture or any culture in particular. This is about the nature of being a writer and whether or not you believe that every individual human has the right to express themselves using the written word. And I believe the answer is yes. You know, we're all entitled to tell our truth. And ultimately, that's why I chose to respectfully disregard that opinion of what I was doing and get on with it.
Yeah.
And I think that was the right decision. But that doesn't mean it was easy.
No, well, and I think that helps all of us with dysfunctional families know that we're not alone. I'm sure there's lots of people.
Well, I mean, we can call them dysfunctional families or just families.
Well, just families.
In a way, these are inevitable.
Yeah.
There's a problem with representation, which is that being represented by somebody else is a difficult experience. And I've been on the other end of that. There was a play on at the Royal Court Theatre about 13 years ago in which I was portrayed. It was a piece of verbatim theatre and I'd given an interview and there was an actor playing me on stage. And I found that deeply uncomfortable. In retrospect, it was very interesting and he was great. But at the time, I thought, cool, I'm not sure about this, whether I want someone else having such control over myself in a way. And these are really moral quandaries that come up in the arts in general, I think. And you can think about them in advance, but there's nothing quite like the baptism of fire of going through it with your actual work and your actual family, I think.
Yeah. We have a few questions that have come in, so I'm going to ask before they get to be too many. And then we're going to go back to this again. So is the Romani language based on the Romanian language? I know you talk about this in the book. Do you want to explain a little bit about that? Because your study of semantics, I think, is really fascinating and language.
Almost unbelievably, the words Romani and Romanian have absolutely no connection to each other at all, which is especially odd, seeing as one of the largest populations of Romani people in the world lives in Romania. So there's a strong attachment in people's minds between the country Romania and Romani people. But actually, there are just as many Romani people in Brazil, the United States, possibly even other European countries like Hungary. And it, nowadays, even the UK has a very sizable Romani population. So there's no connection between those two words. The word Romania, the country Romania, comes from the same root as the Roman Empire, the city of Rome. It was a Roman colony in the time of the Caesars. The word Romani, as in Romani Gypsy, so the Romani language that I've been talking about, comes from an old, a northwestern Indian word, Rom, meaning man or husband. So the name of our language, in our language, Romanes, means it's actually an adverb. It means like one of us, basically. So vracher Romanes means to speak like a Romany person. So that's what we call convergent etymology, I think, or false friends etymologically, is when you get two words that end up looking the same and sounding the same that aren't connected. For instance, the words bear, bear and bear in English, meaning carry, large mammal and naked. It's the same sort of phenomenon, yeah.
Yeah, well, and actually somebody else also, something you also picked up on. I note that you said the Romany word for water, pani, is the Punjabi word for water, and you've already said that. So yes, there's a great connection between...
There are some Romany words that remain identical to the ones used in several Indian languages. And the Romany counting system, if you count in Romany around somebody who speaks an Indian language, they immediately recognise the numbers. Yek, dui, trin, stor, panch. Yeah, 1 to 5, for instance. They're similar. They're the same, really, in several languages.
I find it so fascinating. We've got a question. Can you tell us about the designs in the background? Do they signify something?
Well, they don't signify anything particularly relevant to this conversation, I'm afraid. These cloths belong to my mum, as most of the cloths that I've been exposed to in my life seem to do. My mum studied textile design at art college and is an artist and collects fabric.
She create these? Are they her own designs?
No, I believe this one, she might have picked that up in Zimbabwe, but I'm not sure about that. And this paisley one, I don't know where that's from, but that's just sort of a cheap paisley cloth. They're not mine, and they're not, alas, they're not directly connected to Romany culture.
So we've got another question. How did you travel? Did you use a gypsy caravan and horse?
No, if only I could have. I'm not a good enough horseman to attempt it, to be honest. Nor did I have a wagon or a horse that belonged to me alone. We had family horses, but I didn't own a horse myself. So I couldn't have done that in any way. And I was therefore forced in a way, but also sort of very deliberately, I travelled in a transit van, which is actually the modern vehicle of choice for most Romany travellers. For various reasons. I mean, it's a works vehicle, so you can use it to earn a living. You can also sleep in it. And it tows a trailer very well. So I thought that in terms of getting a bit of the modern experience, it would be more authentic in a way these days to do that. That may sound convenient because I couldn't travel with a horse and wagon, but there was a sort of thought process behind that. And that was partly inspired by the fact that I have experienced, very rarely, but it's happened, being pulled over and harassed by the police, who've clearly, because they thought, oh, you know, he's a pikey and there'll be something untoward, you know, he won't be insured or he'll have some stolen goods in the back of his van and stuff. And then as it becomes clear that in the process of talking to them, that actually I'm a professional writer and that their response is very... is quite a thing to behold. The level of assumption that somebody driving a certain vehicle, wearing certain clothes, is going to be up to no good is powerful among certain police officers, particularly in rural areas. And I've experienced a bit of that, and it is connected to having particularly a transit van with any sort of chrome horse ornament, which is a sort of dead giveaway of a traveller.
I mean, you've been really kind of vocal, haven't you, quite rightly, about this kind of harassment. So can you tell us a bit more about it before we get on to all the other questions? I mean, you've been able to speak out because of your privilege of being a writer and having been now identified as maybe as a kind of gypsy spokesperson. Do you get asked to kind of go on to programmes? Do you talk on the radio? I know you've done a BBC TV show.
Well, it's interesting that you ask about harassment and broadcasting at the same time, because I don't feel like I've experienced much harassment in my life just because of my roots, to be honest. I don't think I'm not readily identifiable as part of the Romany community. In many countries, there's really a not so much a colour line, but a definite gulf in people's the way people are treated and their life opportunities, which is directly related to skin colour. And you see that in Central and Eastern Europe. And in places, I think it does justify being described as apartheid-esque when you have, for instance, young children in Slovakia who, if they're born Romani, are put in a school for children with sort of lesser educational ability. Wow. So when you compare the situation in Britain to things like that, I mean, it doesn't compare in many senses. Harassment of gypsies and travellers is often directly linked to habit of life in Britain, and having only spent parts of my life living in caravans, I haven't experienced that much of it. Most of the upsetting things that have been said to me about my culture, ethnicity, whatever you want to call it, I'm not a massive fan of the word race, even though it does a certain job in conversation, but I sort of try and avoid it in the book and in life in general. Most of the unpleasant things that have said to me have been said on air, live on air, by other journalists, by members of the public, who are happy to say really quite remarkably homogenizing statements about gypsies and travellers that I don't think they'd probably venture on air about other ethnicities. So that is interesting, I think.
Is that why you wanted to do the BBC programme?
The programme I made for BBC Four, which was called A Very British History, Romani Gypsies, I was approached by the director of that, a filmmaker called Adam Keelan, who wanted to make a film. So you can immediately see the idea for the film didn't come directly from me, but he wanted to make a film comparing the situation for gypsies and travellers in the 1960s to the present day. And that immediately struck me as a very interesting project, because the 60s was really a time of great flashpoints and sort of moral panics around gypsies and travellers, because it was the time when many stopped using horses and wagons, and by that point had transitioned into motor vehicles with caravans attached. And the general public's response to that, in large part, was a belief that the true old-fashioned Romanies had disappeared and been replaced by a new and scary breed of highly mobile, sort of semi-urban or suburban people who weren't old-fashioned, oldie-worldie Romani people, but were sort of undeserving, ruthless travellers. In reality, that wasn't the case at all. These people were a mixture of ethnic Romani people, many of whom were born in and grew up and lived in wagons and tents in the past, of Irish travellers who'd recently been moving over in sizable numbers from Ireland, and in some very numerically, almost not insignificant, but in small numbers, there were also people who sometimes get called new travellers, or at the time it was sort of the peace convoy. I don't know whether using the word hippie is particularly sort of polite or desirable in this situation, but friends of mine of that ilk, I think, would forgive me. So there was a small number of sort of hippie travellers as well living on the road. But for the most part, the people who were believed to be this kind of new breed of dangerous, frightening travellers were the same people who'd been bringing in Britain's harvest for centuries, quietly, yeah, in out in the shires. And people hadn't had a problem with that, because I think they saw that as really the role of gypsies and travellers. And it was the acquisition of these new vehicles and these new jobs that brought about a sort of moral panic that led to a raft of new legislation. And we're seeing that again now, really. So that's how that film came about.
I was just thinking how sad that is, the resonance is with today. Let's get out. There's a couple more questions. Actually, there's loads of questions. I've never known so many questions come in. What were the origins of the Romani gypsies? Is one question in the chat.
The origins of the Romani gypsies. So the short answer is Romani culture and the Romani language come from India. About 1,000 years ago, there was probably several emigrations of Indian nomadic people moving slowly westward. And on the way, their language was greatly influenced by other languages. Their culture was influenced by other cultures. So their language, which originally was possibly even a mixture of Indian languages, became influenced by Persian, then enormously by Greek in the time of the Byzantine Empire, and then by every language that its speakers sort of passed through, if you like. So if you take the English Romany language, the one that I grew up speaking, alongside Persian and Greek influence on the original Indian, there are bits of, I mean, Indian isn't a language, sorry, but on the original Indian components of the language, there are bits of Slavic languages, there are bits of Germanic, several German words. There's some Romance language in there. And also on that westward journey, you see varying levels of religious and sort of ethnic influence, if you like. So that would be an explanation as to why I don't look like an Indian person, is that English Romany traveler culture is really the result of a long process of interaction between Roma, ethnic Romany people, and other, probably, again, I'm not a massive fan of the word indigenous in certain contexts, but indigenous travelers, so European nomads who were already here. And then as a result, you get sort of the modern Romany gypsy culture of today. But what the culture became in different lands, it's intriguing the level of difference. So for me to discover probably in my 20s, I found out that there were actually very many Muslim Romany people in, for instance, Turkey, but also parts of the Balkans, even parts of the Middle East. There are people called the Dom or Domari people who were referred to as gypsies before Romany people were, probably. So it's a complicated picture.
Can we talk?
The simple answer is Romany culture and language came from India. Yeah.
So I remember when I first met you and I asked you about the use of the word gypsy, because it's a word I'd always been told I shouldn't use. And I remember you saying specifically, I give you permission to use it. It's a word that you like to use. And I know we talked about the fact that you said in different parts of Romany culture, people dislike the word. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because I think most people who aren't from the Romany community will be really confused about, oh, are you allowed to say the word gypsy on the front cover of a book? And I just think it's fascinating how it provokes discussion.
Well, there are a couple of conversations we could have here, I think. One is about censorship in general and whether any words should be banned from being used in books. And I come down pretty clearly on one side of that argument, which is that to ban any word is a gesture which is really inimical to the possibility of exploring ideas as a writer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that depends on how you're using it, and the context and sensitivities and things like that. But in general, the banning of words is something which authorities which are against exploring ideas do. So that's my perspective on it as a general issue. In terms of this word in particular, yes, I've had very many conversations about that, some of which have been interesting, some of which I find a bit frustrating. Gypsy, it's useful to look at the root of the word, the etymology. So it's really a modified form of the word Egyptian. And Romany culture didn't come originally from Egypt, so technically it's a misnomer. But the first Romany people in Britain referred to themselves probably and certainly were referred to as Egyptians. Over time, you can see the word morph and change from Egyptian to Gypsian to Gypsy. Sort of very interesting to watch it evolve, if you like. And it's a word of great historical importance. It appears in so many of the records. It's a way that people are referred to in parish records, sometimes on birth certificates as wandering Egyptians. Sometimes Romany people's job in census entries is referred to as being travelling gypsies, because it was seen to imply an entire sort of livelihood and culture. So to erase that word, to me, is historically irresponsible and a bit sort of intellectually almost laughable, although I don't find people's feelings about the word laughable, because they come often from a very sincere place. The thing is, the word gypsy is, generally speaking, not as popular with political activists of Romani heritage and some Romani people from continental Europe who see it as the English equivalent of the word, of words like Tsigoina in Germany, in German, Tsigani in Romanian, and both of which, and various other words, originally come from a Greek word, atsinganoi, which literally meant untouchables. So you've got all these words that come from atsinganoi, which are literally offensive. Although there is a possibility that gypsies were called untouchables because they didn't want to be touched, but that's a sort of distant possibility. I won't get into that. And then you have this other set of words which come from Egyptian. And the word Egyptian, as I think we can all agree, is not an offensive word. But this idea, both that it's a misnomer, it misdescribes our heritage, and that it's somehow the English equivalent to all those words that were used by the Nazis and that were Stasha in Croatia and stuff when they were rounding up Romani people and exterminating them. That has all kind of blended together to cause people, in some cases, to really hate the word gypsy. And it's a subject that comes up at a lot of talks I do. Will it cause me to stop using it? Absolutely not. I think it's an important historical word that has a particular attachment to Romani people in the Anglophone world. And that's why Tyson Fury has it embroidered in gold on his boxing trunks. And that's why it's embossed in gold on the cover of the book you just held up. Because I think that in many cases, in many contexts, it's a proud word, a storied word. And unlike the word Romani, which, as the question earlier indicates, people often think means Romanian, I think there is a slightly clearer understanding of what gypsy means. A question's just come through about the negative connotations of gypsy, which perhaps we can talk about.
There's so many questions I can't. So somebody asks, do you think that some of your family is so angry over this book because gypsies get such a bad press now, i.e. through programmes such as My Big Fat Gypsy Wedding?
I don't think that's why some of my relatives were angry about the book. I think they thought that I would be effectively profiting from stories about our family that were private.
Right.
And I think possibly they thought it would be a different kind of book to the book that it in fact is, which is a sort of really a book of the road, a travel book, which has a particular focus on one culture. The book that I haven't mentioned yet, which probably if there was an inspiration for this above anything else, it would be this one, Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, which one of John Steinbeck's later books, in which, as this illustration on the cover shows, he travelled around the perimeter of the continental United States in a custom-built living truck with his poodle, Charlie. I love this book and I didn't want to copy or even emulate it, but it definitely inspired me because Steinbeck went on a journey that really was not arbitrary, but certainly it wasn't a thorough exploration of the terrain. You know, he literally skirted the hem of the country. He never really went inland at all. And it was limited by time and by the people he saw and stuff. And yet what you get is, I think, a really intriguing portrait of the America of that time in the early 1960s. And it also just makes you want to travel. I thought that was wonderful. And I'd read so many books recently about walking, but I grew up wanting to explore on the road and to walk, but to have a vehicle to go back to at night and stuff like that. So a sort of road book involving a vehicle. So that I had that in mind, but I think what perhaps some of my family had in mind that I was going to do was to write a sort of, you know, a tell-all salacious memoir, which would compromise them in some way. And I don't know whether that's connected to Big Fat Gypsy Weddings. Perhaps it was. I mean, at this point, we're going back about 7 years. Gypsies and Travellers did feel quite embattled, I think, by the way we were being presented in the media. But the idea that I was going to do something like that, I find confusing. I mean, I've been working as a journalist, but certainly not making things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a comment here saying, "Hi, Damien, I read your book in 2020 after hearing you, I think, reading extracts on Radio 4, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. At that time, I was working, supporting traveller children who lived mainly on a settled traveller site in the school's catchment area. Attendance at school was always a struggle for some of the families who seemed not to value education. However, as I got to know them better, I formed the opinion that the parents were concerned that if the children were too educated, they would lose their heritage and forget the traditional way of life. The school was always supportive, but after a while, I started to question our policy of improving attendance if it was eroding their heritage. I'd really love to hear your views on this." Great question.
A really great question, to which there's no simple answer, really. I mean, I used to go to meetings at the Department for Education to address these kinds of matters. And the way that it seemed at the time was that there were really two attitudes to this matter. You had the sort of traveller attitude, which again is it's a stereotypical attitude which not everybody shares. I mean, I was encouraged to go to school, and generally speaking, did. I was probably absent more than some of the children, but I attended often enough to do all my exams and things like that. There's a traveller attitude which says beyond a certain point, education becomes of little use if you're going to live the traveller life, if you like. So if you're going to go out working, doing a manual trade and being in business, for instance, it's best to just hit the road running as young as possible. And in many cases, I think that's probably correct. It's taken me, I'm 36, nearly 37 years old. It's taken me so long to sort of cobble together a career as a writer, which brings me any kind of return. That I think many travellers would look at that and say, see, that's what happens. And often they even have...
What happens when you go to Oxford, Damien?
They even have this phrase, educated fools, which means people who've got qualifications coming out of their ears but don't seem able to go out and earn money as well as a traveller who dropped out of school when they were 14 years old. So there's that perspective on the one hand. And then on the other, there are a lot of people, educational professionals, who say travellers have what we refer to as scripts, which are really a set of excuses to take their children out of school. They talk about their heritage. They talk about the need for them to learn a trade, or the fact that they experience bullying, or that their culture is not included in the national curriculum. But really, they just don't want them to go to school because they don't want them to sort of be lost into wider society or to experience that cultural dilution, I think, which the question asked. To be honest, I don't think there's any one answer to any of these questions, and it all depends on the individual family. There are families who are very concerned about their children getting sucked into a culture of, to put it mildly, sex and drugs and rock and roll, which isn't compatible with the sort of conservative family life, if you like, which a conservative of a small C, which some travellers would seek to encourage. And as I said, is perhaps not compatible with getting up on your feet as young as possible and starting to earn your keep. On the other hand, there are Romani barristers, scientists, police officers, teachers, who obviously, you know, that attitude doesn't reflect their experience. So what I really worry about are overly simple responses to complicated questions like that.
And it does bring me neatly onto the fact, because I'm intrigued by the fact that you went to Oxford to study theology and then you become a writer. What led to you? Did you want to go into the church, or what was the reason for that studying? I think it's really fascinating that you then write about something so completely different, unless you're writing about theology now.
There's a partly embarrassing answer, which is...
Oh, good.
When I was 17, 18, applying for university, it was terribly important to me that I should go to Oxford or Cambridge. And I looked at the statistics and saw that it was incredibly difficult to get in for English, or at least sort of statistically unlikely, it seemed to me. And that theology, which I was also very interested in and was studying at the time for A-level, had a better acceptance rate. And it, in particular, it had a much better acceptance rate at the college I ended up at, St. John's College, which I knew had an award scheme of bursaries for less financially well-off students. Yeah. So I looked at all this and thought, I really want to go there. I really need financial support. And I'm worried that I'll blow my chance if I apply for English. So that was part of the reasoning. I don't want to make it sound like I didn't also passionately want to study theology, because I did, and for my sins, did pretty well at it in the end. But in different circumstances, I might have chosen a different subject. But I do write about theology, and it does come through in my work, just perhaps as a sort of a theme beneath the surface, I think, as opposed to, you know, I don't write books about Jesus or the Bible, or but as a theme, it comes across, I think. I mean, I did briefly consider the idea of becoming a cleric, but that was a dream that didn't last very long. I think it's a way of life that's completely incompatible with mine, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. The comment that came in earlier about the cloth behind you, Emma says, that's why she asked, because she has a Zimbabwean dress in that material and she's very excited that your cloth is from the country of her birth. So she's thrilled to see that behind you. That's why.
No, I can't guarantee that, by the way. I'm just, I think possibly it is. My mother spent some time with the people who live in Binga in Zimbabwe a few years ago. But it may, she's probably going to come round this afternoon and tell me it's from Brighton or something.
Doesn't mean it's not from Brighton via Zimbabwe. So we have one comment that says, I had a Romani student who went on to train as a social worker. I thought she'd be brilliant as she had such a fresh way of looking at things. Somebody else says, and I know you wanted to know about people's experiences of travellers. When I was young, in the Scottish Highland, travellers used to come regularly who mended things. They were locally called tinkers. I think they had Irish roots and I think they spoke Gaelic. Does that mean they also have Romani connections? Would you have any idea?
This is unfortunately a subject that I'm not best placed to discuss, certainly not compared to other people who have that background and indeed have written brilliant books about it. So I'd recommend books by the great Scottish storyteller Duncan Williamson or Jess Smith. There's a whole sort of genre of books about traveller life in Scotland, which I recommend you having a little search. Betsy White. I mean, there's so much of it. But generally speaking, and this is an oversimplification, but there's a bit of a division in traveller culture in Scotland between the lowland Romani gypsy heritage and the highland Scottish traveller heritage. And that's an old linguistic division where in the lowlands you have people speaking the Scottish Romani language, which is very similar to the English Romani language that I grew up with, although Scottish gypsy people would say that they pronounce the words correctly and we don't. they do have a more conservative pronunciation system. I won't go into the detail of that, but Scottish Highland traveller people speak a language called the Berle Ricat, which is, as far as I'm aware, a Goidelic language. So it is connected to Scottish Gaelic and Irish. And so there is a cultural linguistic division there. However, there are people who come from a mixed background, as you'd imagine. And in many cases, that divide doesn't apply. And it, in fact, runs straight through people, which is why I'm always a bit funny about these divides, if you like. But yes, certainly, if you encounter travellers speaking their own language in the Highlands, it's highly likely that it would be the Berle Ricat. Yeah.
And we have a question. Are the Bedouin nomads considered to be gypsies too?
The short answer to that is no, I think, because the word gypsy, if it's used in an informed way, it implies some kind of connection to India. If you're talking about ethnicities, that's not how everybody uses it. I mean, there was a question, I think, about the negative connotations of the word gypsy, which I always think is interesting because the word gypsy, I feel, at least for several hundred years, has always had some negative connotations and a rich plethora of romantic, artistic connotations of a sort of aspirational bohemianism. And that's the way that, for instance, rock and roll lyricists use the word, or you know, aristocratic British painters have used the word. So I think that gypsy doesn't solely have negative connotations. But anyway, I think that I've never heard Bedouin people or Berbers or other, you know, Tuareg sort of African or Middle Eastern nomadic people referred to as gypsies. That would be a new one for me.
You mentioned painters, my mum said that she had a really romanticised, idealised view of gypsies when she was little because she loves horses and Alfred Munning's paintings. He did some wonderful works on gypsies. And what was the feeling in the Roma community about Alfred Munning's? Is he known? Is he respected? Is he disliked?
Well, my family had several prints of Alfred Munning's paintings in the home.
Fantastic.
When I was a child. Wonderful. I almost said they had Munning's paintings, but we didn't have that kind of wealth, I'm afraid, if only. But there was a real love for those paintings, I think, because they depicted both the glamour and the hardship of Romany life in various different sort of guises. So there are the ones which are sort of fantastically, in fact, some of them are so romantic that I didn't think they were paintings of travellers at all. I thought they were paintings of rich people from the Wild West when I was a kid, because there were wagons and horses, but also people wearing these kind of dapper hats and three-piece suits and peacock feathers and stuff. And it seemed to be a time and a place that was completely unfamiliar to me. And I was fascinated as I grew up to see that they were depictions of Romany people on fair days. But then there were other Alfred Munning's paintings, which particular one called The White Slave, which is depicts a very hard-looking man pulling a white pony through a muddy horse fair in the winter, which my great-grandmother has a print of. And that depicted the sort of hard side of that outdoor English country life. And I think for that reason, they loved Munning's probably more than other artists.
And was just mentioned
famous for painting gypsies. Yeah. For, you know, somebody just mentioned Augustus John, who wasn't as much discussed in my childhood, except by my dad, who was a big fan of his work, at least, if not his slightly raffish lifestyle. And then
your father was an artist as well. Do you want to tell us a little bit? We haven't got much time left. But do you want to tell
Laura Knight. Someone's just mentioned Dame Laura Knight.
Yes, fantastic. I love Laura Knight.
There's a major exhibition of her work that's just coming to a close in Milton Keynes, where there are many brilliant paintings of Romany people. Again, they tend to be on sort of sunny days when life is good, rather than the other side of it.
Yeah, that's Laura Knight in general. Her work's just always about light. I love her. Anyway, your dad was an artist. So tell us a little bit about your dad, if you wouldn't mind.
My dad, he was preoccupied with depicting really all the uncelebrated and in some cases really disliked corners of British society and culture, I think. So his work's full of football hooligans and London spivs and kind of little street urchins, which is how he used to refer to himself as a child. And all these, you know, mods and rockers, those kind of 60s and 70s music subcultures who there were moral panics about at the time. You'll see all those characters in his work, partly because he'd been several of those things himself at various points in his life. But really, he was most passionate about depicting all different gypsy and traveller cultures of Europe. And as time went on, he became preoccupied with covering maps, so existing maps. He bought hundreds and hundreds of maps, and then he'd smother them with endless faces. And he said, "I'm literally putting gypsies on the map." So the idea was, you know, we're not acknowledged as being part of the land. I'm going to sort of really bolshily almost force an acknowledgement of that presence. And some of those maps, I think, are quite dark as well. Some of them don't just contain faces. They contain thousands of tiny crosses, which I think, I mean, unfortunately, I can't ask Dad anymore because he's no longer with us, but I think they indicate genocide, really.
Right.
So there are various different meanings in there, but really his artistic project was to place front and center people who most of the time in British conversation are seen as not worthy of discussing, basically.
And that brings us very neatly to a question here, which, please forgive my ignorance, but do travellers settle anywhere they like without seeking permission from local councils? That is how the media portrays travellers. Do you have anything you want to say about that?
There are a small number of people who have that attitude. And I would like to discuss, firstly, how small that number of people is, and secondly, why they have that attitude. Firstly, at least 90% of ethnic gypsies and travellers don't live on the road anymore, or don't even live in caravans. And of that, perhaps 10% that do, the vast majority, I can't give a percentage, but almost all of them live on legally rented or owned caravan sites. And then you have this minority within a minority who still live on the road. And within that minority, there is a tiny, really a vanishingly small number of people estimated as the inhabitants of about 1,000 caravans who pull their caravans onto places that cause community tension, as it's sometimes referred to. Whilst I'm not an apologist for that, to the extent that it interferes with other people's daily life, and sometimes it clearly does, sometimes it really doesn't, and they move on quickly and don't leave a mess, which is difficult to report on. It's difficult to take photos of no mess as a photojournalist, for instance. I can assure you that I didn't used to leave any, and I used to pick up other people's, which was often very unpleasant. But when we think about that minority within a minority within a minority, I think it's irresponsible to talk about it without acknowledging the fact that traditional gypsy and traveller stopping places in England have been almost without exception rendered inaccessible to the people whose ancestors used to stay in them for hundreds of years. And that was a process which in the 70s and 80s sort of accelerated until there were almost none left. So this issue feels slightly different from the perspective of, if you take someone like myself, when I have to drive past a place where members of my family who were still alive were born, but which is now surrounded by a ditch and a set of wooden stakes driven into the ground and a height restrictor to guarantee that we can't ever spend the night there anymore. I'm not making excuses for people who have a certain slightly aggressive attitude as in response to that, or for any of their behaviour, because it's got nothing to do with me. I'm not responsible for the behaviour of others, really. But there will always be a slight sympathy when people are made angry by the way that the stopping places have been treated. And I think that there's a wider issue here, which goes beyond gypsy and traveller culture, which is that the vast majority of land in this country is not accessible to the general public, and that we need a change in attitude, like the one that's happened north of the border in Scotland, allowing better land access to normal people. And the gypsy conversation is simply one aspect of a very large and important conversation about that.
I'm so glad that question was asked. There are so many more. I'm going to ask lovely Stephanie when this is finished, and we're very, very close to the end, if she could send you the questions, Damien, because she...
Sure, I'll try and answer them in writing if I've got time.
It's fantastic. There's so many. Thank you, everyone. Wow, you've been amazing today. Before you all log
off... By the way, many of the questions I've seen pop up are answered in this. I'm not...
Yeah, they are.
Recommending that you buy it, but there's an audio book.
I am recommending you buy it. Yeah, that's absolutely true. A lot of the questions have been answered in here, and I'm really pleased so many of you have engaged. And I will get Stephanie to send this to Damien very quickly, just to let you know what's coming up. So next week, you've got Humphrey Twice. On Thursday, the 24th of February, he's talking to Lena Sisko, former American naval interrogator. And she's written a book called You're Lying, Secrets from an Expert Military Interrogator to Spot the Lies and Get to the Truth. I can't tell you how glad I am that it's Humphrey who's interviewing her, not me. I think I'd be absolutely terrified. And then after that, we've got... I'm We've got the Book of the Month Club, which is Tom Clancy's The Hunt for Red October. That's also with Humphrey next Friday. And then the following Thursday, the 3rd of March, I'm talking to a really fascinating woman, Nicola Bowman, who founded Persephone Books, which some of you may have known when it was in London. It's now in Bath. It's a gorgeous bookshop and publisher, and they're amazing.
And they are.
They are, aren't they? They're just fantastic. And then on the 4th of March, Humphrey is interviewing Carol Walker, an award-winning BBC correspondent who left war zone reporting to raise her young family and became a political correspondent. She's written a book called Lobby Life Inside Westminster's Secret Society. So we've got loads of great things coming up. Thank you so much, Damien. You've been brilliant. Damien and I are now going to turn off our videos. And Stephanie's going to put up a quick poll. Just want to say thank you so much, Damien, for everyone who's coming. I've never seen...
Thank you for having me. Thanks for the questions. It was lovely to take part.
Brilliant questions. Thank you, everybody.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt GOLDSTER. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.